You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Amanda Petrusich returns to the show this week. Journalist Amanda Petrusich is a frequent contributor to New Yorker magazine, and her work has appeared in the New York Times and Playboy and on NPR and lots of places. She's the author of several books, including Nick Drake's Pink Moon and the wonderful Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records, which we talked about here a couple years ago. Amanda Petrusich also wrote the liner notes for the latest entry in Bob Dylan's Bootleg Sessions series. This one, volume 13, focuses on the controversial period of Dylan's career when he devoted himself to religious gospel music. So, a lot to talk about. Amanda Petrusich, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, thank you so much for having me.
What are you listening to currently? What's on your turntable?
Ah, it's always such a stressful question for a music critic. I have been listening a lot to a record that came out. It's just a sort of straight-ahead indie rock record that came out earlier this year by a band called Big Thief from Brooklyn. But it ended up sort of surprising, kind of taking me by surprise and becoming one of my favorite records this year. So I've been sort of spinning that more or less constantly for the last month or so. But, you know, my line of work sort of points me toward different things. I wrote a piece about the new U2 record, so there was a kind of strange week in which I listened to more U2 than I normally would. And, you know, sort of here and there, different things kind of get lodged on my turntable for professional reasons.
Do they ever ask you to review something and then, you know, it's like a kind of music you don't want to listen to, or you're just completely turned off to, or do they usually steer you toward the things they know you're going to like? Well, how could they know?
Right. Well, no, good point. How could I know? I mean, sometimes I'm sort of surprised by my own tastes as well. I would say by and large, I mean, if there's a big release from a major artist that the New Yorker feels like, well, we should cover this in some way, or we should sort of address this in some way. So a band like U2, we did it with John Mayer earlier this year. Fish played a long string of shows at Madison Square Garden in New York. So things like that maybe I wouldn't sort of play squarely in my kind of wheelhouse as far as taste goes, I will find myself writing about, which can be fun. It can be a sort of strange and sort of wondrous journey as I learn a lot about a band that, you know, that I otherwise would have kind of handily and sort of promptly dismissed. So it does allow for some interesting discoveries. I also feel like, all the big major pop stars, so Lady Gaga or Taylor Swift or Katy Perry, you know, when they release a record, it's a sort of big deal both in the industry and sort of within the culture. So we'll want to respond to it in some way. So, yeah, so I end up spending time with artists like that, too, that you know, maybe I would sort of steer around otherwise.
Last time we talked, you were just, like, totally obsessed with old blues 78 records. So do you still get a chance to listen to that old stuff, too?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's still sort of where my heart lies. You know, if I had it my way, it would be, you know, 1929 musically, not in other ways, but yeah, I mean, that kind of pre-war American vernacular music, whether it's, you know, Mississippi blues or Cajun records, or kind of hillbilly gospel, really, really early country music, that's still the stuff that I have the most kind of visceral and emotional reaction to. So, yeah, absolutely. That stays with me kind of year in and year out. And every once in a while I'll have a chance to, you know, to write about some of it for The New Yorker. I got to do a piece late last year about Washington Phillips, who's a really incredible musician from Texas, who a terrific reissue label called Dust to Digital was reissuing some of his work. So that was there are chances like that, too, where you know, I get to kind of indulge my own personal obsessions.
You spent some time recently, I read, looking at Neil Young's obsessions. You went and saw this gigantic auction that Neil Young is holding or just held, and you wrote a little bit about it. What was that all about?
Yeah, I was in California, so in your side of the country. I was in LA for a few days and got a chance to visit the auction house where Neil Young was auctioning off a great deal of his belongings. There had been sort of, you know, rumors that this has something to do with Neil Young perhaps going through a divorce, but the kind of storyline, you know, that the auction house was telling was it was just, you know, time to sort of unload some of his possessions. And a portion of the proceeds from the auction were going to the Bridge School, which is a charity and an organization that he supported for years and years. But it was really wild. I mean, for me, as a person who's interested in collectors and collecting and the kind of material history of a life and objects and all of that. It was, you know, sort of perfect storm of my interests in some ways. And Neil Young himself was a huge collector of Lionel toy trains. So the auction had, you know, dozens and dozens of these really rare trains from the Lionel archives that, you know, Young had sort of acquired along the way. And I'm not really a train person. I didn't know very much about that whole kind of world. I recognized the, you know, the collector's fanaticism and the sort of the realization of an obsession, you know, just in sort of seeing all these trains. But it was kind of interesting to learn their histories and a little bit about the history of the company and sort of Young's relationship with that stuff. But, you know, it was also a lot of guitars and amplifiers and recording equipment. And kind of the most thrilling part, which I'm embarrassed to admit, were his flannel shirts, which are just so sort of iconic, you know, and his hats and the bolo ties and all of that. I'm not usually a wardrobe kind of person, but I was, you know, to reach out and sort of touch one of those, it was a little bit of a thrill. So that was kind of a fun and weird thing that I got to do, sort of lay my hands on all that stuff. And to, in that process, sort of try to divine, like, well, what, you know, what does this tell us about Neil Young and his career, and sort of what can we learn from this strange warehouse full of stuff?
What does it tell us about Neil Young?
Well, I mean, I think that the sort of trick and the kind of myth of all of this is the idea that you could sort of, you know, conjure a reasonable or a thoughtful or even a consistent narrative. I mean, I think, you know, looking, he's obviously a guy who sort of prizes vintage equipment, analog equipment, you know, even the flannel shirts. There is some sort of aesthetic there, you know, that you begin to see forming, and surely you can hear it on his records, but it's kind of cool to see it carry over into his stuff. You know, he likes mechanical things. Like, he likes things that are, you know, don't have significant sort of digital components. He likes things that will work, you know, 100 years after they were made. So, yeah, the sort of sturdiness of his stuff I was impressed by and found kind of consistent with his music.
I wonder, I mean, I know those trains are valuable, but I guess they're even more valuable because they were Neil's trains.
It was funny. I talked to the auctioneer and one of the executives at the auction house who was saying, you know, they'd been getting a lot of registrations for bidders who were not based in major cities and were not sort of the usual suspects in terms of who buys, you know, rock star stuff from these auctions. And Neil Young himself, I think, had a sense that some of the people that would come out to bid would just be train collectors who, you know, don't know who Neil Young is and don't care that a rock star owned this thing. They just want the train. So it was a funny sort of mix of you know, people who are really fanatical fans or followers of Neil Young, and then I think people who are just interested in trains, and the fact that Neil Young owned the train was, you know, meaningless, essentially.
I used to work in this art store, and this old guy came in to get some supplies for his railroad, and I said, oh, you have a train set? And he said, don't call it a train set. It's a scale model railroad. Okay, sorry.
That's pretty great. That, I will say, reminds me of, you know, 78 collectors. When you call, you know, the 78s themselves, if you call them LPs or if you refer to them as being vinyl, you know, it would drive them bananas because, of course, they aren't LPs and they're made of shellac. So, yeah, collectors can be quite exacting about about their work.
I want to ask you about a couple of things about your Playboy interview with Scarlett Johansson. So the issue that your interview, which was a great interview, by the way,
Thank you.
It was a kind of a big deal issue because it was the issue that Playboy returned to having pictures of women without their clothes on, which is, of course, you know, what they're famous for.
Sure.
And, of course, the articles. So, I mean, you know, that particular issue was probably their biggest selling issue in years, and you're in it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Playboy, I feel like, you know, probably every woman on earth has a kind of strange and complicated relationship to Playboy, but of course, and it's almost embarrassing to say this out loud because it's a punchline, but, you know, for me as a journalist and a fan of new journalism and literary journalism and narrative reporting, I mean, the magazine, it was sort of a thrill for me to write for them just to kind of join some of that company. And the Playboy interview in particular, which was, so my Scarlett Johansson piece was what they call the Playboy interview, which is a big, you know, 8, 9, 10,000 word interview in the middle of the magazine. That's a sort of Q&A format. some of the Playboy interviews from the archives, you know, are the definitive interview with an artist. I mean, the Bob Dylan Playboy interview is a, you know, an interview I go back to often. The Dolly Parton one is amazing. There's all these incredible sort of sit-downs between, you know, when it works well, it's kind of two interesting, curious minds in conversation with each other. So it was exciting to, you know, be a part of that lineage. But, of course, there's this whole other history of Playboy as a pornographic magazine. God bless them. Anyway, I did not know when I took that assignment that it would be the issue where the naked women came back. So that was just a sort of funny thing that I learned in production.
So you did have, there's some part of you that had reservations, especially, you know, kind of in our current climate about being contributing to Playboy.
I mean, sure. Yeah, of course. I have a complicated relationship with, you know, with that whole idea, or really, frankly, with pornography in general, just sort of, you know, is this a societal ill? Are there ways in which this is healthy for the culture? I don't know. You know, it's a strange thing that I have not quite reasoned out for myself. So, yeah, absolutely. I think there's always the fear that, you know, is this somehow in some kind of inadvertent way contributing to the degradation of women or contributing to a sort of culture of violence against women. You know, and one hopes not, and one also hopes that in 2017 the women that are choosing to pose for Playboy are, you know, doing that with sort of all their faculties intact and making an informed decision, and, you know, who am I to sort of stand in judgment of that? But yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, luckily my parents think it's hilarious. My mom, when she got a copy of the magazine, just was telling all of her friends in their retirement community in Florida that her daughter was in Playboy.
My daughter's in Playboy.
Yeah, she just loves it. She, you know, the looks of sort of heart. Nobody knew what to say in response.
That's pretty funny. But now, so the interview, which I really thought was fascinating, mainly because, you know, first of all, it was you, and I'm always interested in reading what you write. And I also like Scarlett Johansson. I mean, you know, who doesn't?
Yeah.
Because she's so great. And a lot of people probably don't even see her as a musician, even though she's got two albums out. And one of her albums, I think both of her albums are really interesting. One of them, I think, is really great. And
You
were sort of the first person that I've seen in the press approach her as a musician.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, one of the, again, sort of really exciting things about that feature is that it's, you know, it's a 3 or 4 hour interview. So you're sort of sitting down and you kind of get to go places that, you know, otherwise would not happen in your sort of typical 20-minute phone call with a celebrity of that caliber, especially an actor. So it was really fascinating and you know, edifying and intriguing to sort of be able to talk to her about her musical career and, you know, her musical tastes and sort of who she is as a singer and, you know, her relationship to certain records. And, you know, we certainly share some loves. I mean, she's a huge Dylan fan. She was in a Dylan video. She's a huge Tom Waits fan. She, you know, recorded an album that's just covers of Tom Waits songs. So, you know, some choices that I think are maybe a little idiosyncratic or sort of interesting for someone who does the kind of work that she does. And she's a great listener, you know, in terms of, you know, she listens sort of broadly and she listens intensely. So it's just fun to kind of get into the, you know, the nitty gritty of music with her. So that was a, you know, kind of a joy for me because obviously that's my passion, you know, even more so than filmmaking. That was, you know, it was exciting to talk to her about that stuff.
Are you and ScarJo pals now? Do you?
I hope so. I know she was happy with how the interview turned out. Although, of course, as a journalist, that, you know, should not be your agenda or of great concern to you. But, you know, as a human being, of course, you want to feel like you represented someone and the time that you had together fairly and accurately. But yeah, so yes, I hope so. I have actually talked, funnily enough, that was my third interview with Scarlett Johansson. So I feel like now, at this point, if we're not at least, you know, vaguely friendly, something has gone wrong.
And so you were actually sitting with her, with, you know, across from her while you were doing it.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, it was in person. I mean, that's another, the Playboy interviews are kind of contingent upon the artist being available to do it in person.
Well, it came out great. I loved it. And also, you know, there's pictures of naked ladies.
Yeah. No shame, Jerry. No, it's, yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much. Here I go again.
pass and try. All the good times lie ahead. Oh, oh. Last thing I remember, things were getting better.
That was Scarlett Johansson and Peter Yorn. Scarlett Johansson was the subject of an interview in Playboy magazine conducted by my guest, Amanda Petrusich. And we'll continue talking with Amanda Petrusich right after this. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And we continue now with our conversation with music critic and New Yorker staff writer Amanda Petrusich. In May of 2017, rock musician Greg Allman passed away. And you were commenting about him on NPR, and I was so fascinated by what you were talking about. And they gave you, I don't know, think about 6.5 seconds to talk. So I want to come back to that and see if there's anything more you wanted to say or expand on your feelings about Greg Allman.
Yeah, that's tough. Those radio interviews are tough, especially the when someone dies and it's, you know, you pop. And I got in the last year, have written more, in my capacity as a staff writer from New Yorker, I've written more obituaries or postscripts, as we call them at the magazine, than I ever imagined possible. And it is a weird thing to try to, you know, metabolize the death of an artist. And you know, there's a personal sort of wound and a personal moment of mourning there when someone whose work meant a lot to you, you know, disappears from this earth. But then there's this extra thing of sort of trying to figure out how they fit into the culture and, you know, what their work means and how do we sort of quantify this person's life. And it's all happening very, 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 very fast. So that's a challenge. The funny thing about being a professional music critic, and I'm sure, you know, other sorts of critics and culture writers have to do it within their fields too, but it felt like, God, in 2017 we really lost a lot of major musicians. And so then, you know, yeah, you've got 10 seconds to sort of tell listeners or tell whoever it is why they should care about Greg Allman. And it's tough. You know, it's not easy, and I don't always know that I do it well. But I mean, he's someone who I think, I'm a huge Allman Brothers fan. Are you also?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I had seen him in concert just like 2 years before to the day. And he was great.
Oh, wow.
He was outstanding. So I was, I mean, I knew he was sick, but I was still shocked by his death.
Yeah, he sort of seemed like somebody who was just going to live forever. You know, he'd lived hard and he'd made it to, you know, to his 70s. And I think there was some sense of, you know, he wasn't going to stop now. But, of course, he is human like all of us. But, yeah, I mean, for me, the Allman Brothers are always an interesting band. I think, you know, not only for the really important work that they were doing, you know, in the late 60s when they started, in terms of having an interracial band, you know, in a town like Macon, Georgia, which was really not a place where, you know, those sorts of things happened. And it's funny, it's a funny and complicated legacy, because later on, I feel like as a, you know, being so essential to the sort of genesis of Southern rock and being such kind of torchbearers for that sound and that subculture, you know, they became associated with the Confederate flag and, you know, all this other stuff that people think of when they think of Southern rock, or they think of the legacy of Southern rock, or they think of people like, you know, Kid Rock or Hank Williams, you know, the Third.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt so sort of horrifying to me, because it, you know, seemed so kind of counter to who that band was and, you know, and the sort of really brave things that they were doing in the 60s. But yeah, you know, they were, I had a chance to write about the Allman Brothers for the music issue of the Oxford American in, it was either late 2015 or early 2016 when it came out, I can't quite remember, and had spent some time in Macon and a little time in Daytona, which is where the, you know, Duane and Greg were from, and, you know, they still feel to me like such a product of that kind of extraordinary, you know, American landscape. So that one was a tough loss. That was a really hard one.
They were also such, you know, despite the fact that they're known as this Southern rock group, I mean, they were really inspired by jazz and sort of the improvisational John Coltrane kind of thing, and having the two drummers in the band and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. Jazz, blues. I mean, and, you know, an incredibly musically sophisticated and complicated band. That, yeah, I think, you know, all that stuff, I think over the years, as the sort of subversiveness of the Allman Brothers kind of, you know, faded into the background a little bit. You know, their legacy got rewritten in some funny ways. So it did feel like an opportunity, like, well, let's talk about what this band really, you know, really did. And even, you know, I don't know if you heard Greg's last album, Low Country Blues, or his last album, you know, before he passed away.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it's a collection of covers, you know, that he produced with T-Bone Burnett. And, you know, there's a few tracks on there that I just think are just staggeringly good. You know, and it sort of, you know, twists the knife a little bit in terms of, you know, losing him when we did. Because I think he was still making really exciting music.
I believe I'll go back home.
That was Greg Allman from his album Low Country Blues, the last album released in his lifetime. We were just discussing with my guest, music critic and New Yorker staff writer Amanda Petrusich. And there's also another Greg Allman album that was released posthumously. Amanda Petrusich, have you had a chance to listen to that one yet?
I haven't listened to it yet, but I know it's in my pile of things once all the sort of year-end stuff goes away. Yeah, I'm really excited to sit down and spend some time with that one.
He does a great cover of Dylan's Going, Going, Gone on that, which made me think of Warren Zevon's cover of Knocking on Heaven's Door on Warren Zevon's last album.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's kind of a fun musical rabbit hole you just fell down. I would like to sort of cue all those up in order.
Last album songs, yeah. And of course we lost Tom Petty, then that was a real shocker.
Yeah, you know, and that one was, I mean, for a reporter, you know, it was really strange because it was sort of unclear what was going on. You know, at first there were reports that he had passed away, and then it was, you know, no, he hasn't, he's in a coma, who knows what's going to happen. So there was this sort of like, do we pull the trigger on, you know, covering this or not? Of course, one of the worst things a publication can do is, you know, pronounce someone dead before they have actually died. So there was this, you know, I remember hearing that news in my head. I was at an airport in Memphis. I was flying back from a different story. I'd just been at Graceland, which was a kind of heavy, you know, already a sort of heavy experience. Yeah, and I remember my editor saying, like, can you write something now? And I was like, well, I'm on a plane that's about to take off. Like, I'll send you this, but, you know, please don't publish it until we know for sure. And then, of course, they're up in the air and you don't really know what's going on. And that was a tough one and a surprise, and you know, I think we'll sort of feel the sting of it for a while. Even now when I hear a Petty song come on the radio, and you hear them a lot, you know, they're played on the radio a lot, they're played in, you know, public spaces more or less constantly, I still feel that sort of twinge of, you know, I just liked knowing Tom Petty was around. I just liked knowing he was still alive and doing his thing, and it's hard. It seems sort of sentimental to say you miss, you know, these people that you never knew, but nonetheless, I miss them.
Sometimes the twinge never goes away. I mean, I'm not over John Lennon yet.
Yeah. That's I can't even, you know, Lennon was shot in early 1980, is that right?
December 8th,
1980. Yeah. I was about 11 months old, so I
oh, yeah.
don't remember that one with quite as much clarity, but
what's the matter with
but
you?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, a loss like that, I think, is going to reverberate for a while, for sure.
I
under my feet, baby. Grass is growing. It's time to move on. Time to get going. Broken skyline, moving to the airport. She's an honest defector, conscientious objector, now her own protector. Yeah, broken skyline. Which way to love land? Which way to something better? Which way to forgiveness? Which way do I go? Yeah, it's time to move on. Time to get going. What lies ahead, I have no way of knowing. But under my feet, baby, grass is growing. It's time to move on. Time to get going. Sometime later, getting the words wrong, wasting the meaning, losing the rhyme. It's nauseous adrenaline, breaking up a dogfight like a deer in the headlights, frozen in real time. I'm losing my mind. It's time to move on, time to get going. What lies ahead, I have no way of knowing. But under my feet, baby, grass is growing. It's time to move on, it's time to get going.
Oh, that was the late Tom Petty. My guest is Amanda Petrusich, and she's a staff writer for New Yorker, and her recent pieces include not only articles about music, but also food, television, and the Winter Olympics. Amanda Petrusich, your work is very well researched, and you're obviously not just sitting behind a desk.
Yeah, there's a lot of travel, which is, you know, a gift, and I feel fortunate for, although it's also exhausting. And then often, kind of depending on the project, there can be a lot of archival research, there can be a lot of interviews. It's always important for me, I think, whenever I'm working on a piece to sort of braid those things in such a way that it's, you know, informative for a reader without being boring. And you know, that there's an element of sort of who the person was, but then also something about, you know, the lineage that they come from, or the sort of, you know, the history of the sort of mode in which they're operating. So I always feel like there's some, yeah, historical component to almost everything I write, which can be fun. It means I'm always getting to, you know, learn and explore new things.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with journalist Amanda Petrusich. She has just contributed the album notes to a new album called The Bootleg Series, Volume 13, Trouble No More, 1979 to 1981, from Bob Dylan. An album that focuses on Bob Dylan's born-again Christian period. Let's listen to a track from The Bootleg Series, Volume 13, Trouble No More, before we continue our conversation with Amanda Petrusich.
Sometimes it feels so low down and disgusting. Can't help but wonder what's happening to my companion. I've lost the heart they found. Every kind of the cost it'll take to bring down. The principles they're gonna have to abandon. But there's a slow train coming. I had a woman, had an Alabama. She was a backwards girl, but she was realistic.
Yes.
That was Bob Dylan from his album Trouble No More, the Bootleg Series Volume 13, 1979 to 1981, a deluxe box set that features album notes by my guest, Amanda Petrusich. And you wrote these notes, and they're fantastic notes, and I hope you win the Grammy for them. But
Thank you.
Tell me, how did you get the gig, and then how did you go about researching it all?
Sure. You know, I had published a piece in the New Yorker about this kind of really strange and interesting passion project of a young man who lives in the East Village here who's trying to get the Williamsburg Bridge renamed after the saxophonist Sonny Rollins, who spent a period of time woodshedding on the bridge. You know, kind of took a break early on in his career. He had had terrific success, but sort of had this moment where he felt like he needed to regroup. So he quit recording and would go up every day to the top of the Williamsburg Bridge and, you know, practice for hours. So I'd written a piece about Sonny Rollins and about the effort to rename the bridge after him. And it was read by Jeff Rosen, who is Dylan's manager. And Jeff sent me an email one day saying, you know, I like your style, kid. Are you a Dylan fan? Would you be interested in doing something for this project we have coming up? And, of course, it being the Bootleg series, there's a sort of shroud of secrecy around the whole thing. And, you know, until you kind of sign on for good, they don't really want to tell you too much. Because there are people who sort of eagerly await that information when they do a big formal announcement. So I went in to meet with Jeff Rosen, which was, as a Dylan nerd, you know, incredibly exciting, because in his office he has the original painting, the self-portrait that's on the cover of Self-Portrait. It's just sort of hanging in his office, you know, and I'm sure he looks at it all day and is tired of it. But for me it was a kind of strange thrill. So, you know, he played me some of the songs and, we watched some of the footage and, you know, he said, do you think this is a strange period? You know, do you think this is something you'd be interested in taking on? And of course I said yes. So, you know, for me, that period of Dylan, I feel like for many people, it's sort of the last Dylan you get around to after you've exhausted all the other Dylan. And it's a, you know, kind of critically maligned, I think, and somewhat sort of misunderstood period in his career, or maybe not so much misunderstood as just sort of under-considered. I think it was written off as, you know, a kind of brief period of insanity. So there was something exciting, I think, for me as a writer about, you know, again, not exactly writing a wrong, but sort of being able to give a little more attention to a period that you know, maybe hadn't received as much as, you know, some of his other records. And of course, when you're writing about Dylan, it's like, is there any meat left on the bone at all? You know, it's...
There's only 24,000 books about him, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, literal encyclopedias about the guy. So this felt like a, you know, an opportunity in some ways to maybe write something about Dylan that hadn't been written before. So it was exciting for me in that way, and also just exciting musically. I don't know. Are you a fan of that period?
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. I was there. You were only 11 months old, but I was at several of those shows.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think there was something in his performance then that was, you know, I think horrifying and sort of strange to people, but now with some distance, I think looking back on it, you sort of see a guy that's kind of seized by this extraordinary belief, you know, and he's trying to save souls. I mean, he's preaching from the stage, and I think it was off-putting to a lot of his audience and certainly confusing. I don't know how it was for you.
Well, you can hear in this record that he has a lot of passion for that music, more so than he's had for a lot of other periods in his career.
Yeah, I mean, it was high stakes, you know, and you can hear that in his voice. You can hear it in the performances. I think you can hear it in the band, you know, that this was extraordinarily important to him, sort of life or death important. And for a figure like Dylan, I feel like that's, you know, we don't always get that. You don't always get that Bob Dylan. So I think there's something really extraordinary about that, and I think the way it manifests musically is really interesting, and there's a lot of material on that set, but some of it is just, you know, mind-blowingly good. But I was also interested in this sort of human thing that happened. You know, he says that he saw Jesus in a motel room in Tucson, which sounds like a Bob Dylan lyric, right? I mean, it sounds made up. But here's this, like, really, you know, sort of vulnerable moment in which he is kind of gripped by this, you know, unwavering certainty in you know, in the presence of God and the sort of manifestation of God. And it just felt so human to me. And again, that's a Dylan we don't get a lot of either. You know, there are times when he's a trickster and he's a raconteur and he's a genius. But that really sort of vulnerable, kind of tender Dylan, you know, we don't see that a lot. So I was also excited to kind of chew on that for a little while. And I hope the piece does that, sort of looks at, you know, what happens to kind of make a person have a religious epiphany. What does it mean to have a religious epiphany? You know, what else was going on in the country and in Dylan's life at that precise moment that made that, you know, that night in Tucson, the sort of night that this happened. So those were the questions that were on my mind as I started writing.
Well, so now you know, I mean, I don't know if you had, if they let you meet Dylan, but Dylan obviously has read this thing.
Yeah, he edited it.
Really? What was that?
Yeah, which is pretty wild. I don't know if I'm even allowed to be talking about this. He had the top edit on the notes. So, you know, I went back and forth with Jeff, and, you know, when I finally handed, and I think the thing that I wrote was maybe not exactly what they were expecting, to be honest, but they were sort of game to kind of give it a shot. And, yeah, he made the final edits, and there were a few things in there, you know, that I think he thought were too personal and he wanted taken out. There were a few places where he gave me quotes. So it's not exactly like I interviewed Dylan, but he, you know, gave me some quotes to put in certain places in lieu of, you know, other stuff that was there. So that, I mean, you know, for a Dylan fan and for a rock critic, to be edited by Bob Dylan is a, you know, a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and terrifying, but also, you know, funny and great, and I wouldn't give it up for anything.
And, you know, one of the things I love about Amanda Petrusich is this book, Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 Records, that we talked about last time. And I think it's just a great book. I love it. And I also love your Nick Drake book, which is in that 33 and a Third series. It's such a great little series of books about records.
Such a cool series. I'm now one of four series editors for the 33 and a Third project, so I get to sort of dip my hands, you know, put on my editor's hat, which I don't get to do too often, and, you know, work with writers on their books. But it's such a cool idea for a series, and I think the books, you know, really kind of fill, especially in our sort of present day where, you know, nobody's really, of course, I just talked about writing liner notes, but I feel like people are less likely to read liner notes or to sort of buy physical objects that include liner notes. So I feel like the books sort of function in some way as, you know, a contemporary iteration of that, which is really cool.
Tara Murtha was here talking about her book about Bobby Gentry in that series that I love.
Oh, it's such a terrific book. She's an amazing writer.
Yeah, she's great. So what about you? Will there be another book from you, or are you too busy with all these assignments?
Yeah, I hope so. I keep having, you know, these sort of false starts on things where I think, like, all right, this is going to be it. I've got an idea. I'm going to run with this. And then I, you know, I don't know, I chicken out. So I'm still sort of waiting to alight on kind of the perfect thing. I mean, I'm fortunate in some ways that, you know, I teach full-time at New York University, and then I'm also, you know, on staff essentially full-time at The New Yorker. So, you know, these are great problems to have, but there's a lot of work, you know, that I can kind of fill my days with without thinking about sort of longer projects. But I hope so. I've had the chance to do a couple longer kind of reported magazine features in the last couple of years, some of which I've thought maybe could be turned into a book, but no plans at the moment. And I'm sort of enjoying the kind of, you know, The New Yorker is the first publication that I've been on staff for, so I'm sort of enjoying the kind of strange clip at which I'm now moving, where it's like every week, you know, there's another column. So we'll see. I hope so. I do love books, and I love the kind of long and arduous process of writing a book, and I love the commitment to it, and I love the way, you know, sort of follows you around. So I hope to. I hope to do that again.
Well, Pete Hamill was on the show once, so you're not the only Dylan album notes guest that I've ever had.
Oh, very cool.
But you are the only guest that I can think of who has her own caricature.
I'm very proud of that caricature, I have to say. That was, you know, everyone says the first time you see your byline in the New Yorker font is when, you know, the heart kind of stops. But for me, it was definitely that funny little head, you know, that accompanies all of my pieces now, especially because that little cartoon head has a pair of sunglasses perched atop, you know,
yes,
atop her head, which I, when they asked me for a photo that they would send on to the illustrator to kind of create the avatar, I sent the photo in, and I said sort of jokingly, make me look cool. And the illustrator, this incredible artist named Stanley Chow, he definitely did. So I'm proud of the avatar, and also proud of her sunglasses.
Well, it wasn't hard to make you look cool, because Oh. You're cool. well, Amanda Petrusich, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again soon.
Absolutely. Anytime, Gary. Thank you so much. I really so enjoy speaking with you and being on the show.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Amanda Petrusich. You can find her work in New Yorker magazine and at newyorker.com. And she contributed the album notes to the new Bob Dylan album, Trouble No More. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.